that I have made some modest modifications to the presentation from what was originally submitted. So what is in tab 1, number 4, some of the slides are out of order. I've added one or two additional ones, hopefully to make it clearer and hopefully not confusing things by having done that. But for the most part, it'll be pretty much the same as what's in there. So I'd like to review some of the recent environmental variability that we've seen in the Gulf of Maine, and also to at least briefly consider some of the implications that might have for the fisheries. Basic outline is, first I'll indicate what changes we've documented in the data that we have, then give a little bit of some of the basic oceanographic background to help explain or help understand where those changes have come from, and finally to consider what the implications would be for the fisheries. On that last point, in truth, I don't have many points to make, and I'd be very interested in feedback and input here or later on issues that we should be that I should be considering or the group I have should be considering. First, and this is, I guess, somewhat of an apology for perhaps some of the answers or equivocation that we've given in the past when asked. Oftentimes you're asked, was it warmer or colder last year? It seems like a pretty easy question, you know, pretty straightforward. Turns out that it's not really as easy as it might think. However important it might feel, it's not always an easy question, because it depends upon where you're talking about, inshore, offshore, Gulf of Maine, you know, Georges Bank, wherever. It also depends upon, you know, when or how long a period of time one is concerned about. Spring, fall, a particular day, a particular season, the whole year, or one's talking about the surface of the bottom or the midwater. Depending upon those points, the answer could very well change. And some of the data that I'll be showing, I hope, you know, makes that point, and you won't feel that if we don't give what seems to be a straight answer, sometimes there's good reason for it. The data sources that I'll be using are three. First is from the NIMS surveys, and we'll be dealing with temperature and salinity, primary water properties. NIMS has a number of surveys in addition to the spring and fall trawl surveys. We have plankton surveys, and essentially every time one of our vessels goes out, we do make environmental observations. We generally, in summarizing those data, we generally summarize them into regions, the Eastern Gulf of Maine, Western Gulf of Maine, Georges Bank, just to give an easier index of what the conditions are. The second source of data will be two of the NOAA weather buoys. I've chosen buoy 7 and buoy 5 here. Those make surface temperature measurements continuously every hour. And that's somewhat going to be showing an inshore versus offshore type of comparison. And the third set of data is a program that's called EMULT, which is Environmental Monitors on Lobster Traps. And that program has been supplying temperature data. And I'll start there. And EMULT is a program that's been funded by the Northeast Consortium for the last few years, not the last 5 years. It was originated and has been primarily run by Jim Manning out of the center, but in cooperation with a number of the lobster associations around the Gulf of Maine. And basically what the program is that the lobstermen are provided small temperature recorders that they put on their lobster traps, and they measure continuously bottom water temperature while the traps are deployed. Part of the program was for, in a couple of cases, for the lobstermen to agree to keep a trap in the same location. So we're getting continuous measurements at set points, so you can get a real good time series out of that. And these are two plots, one from a trap that's off of Grand Manan, another one in Mass Bay. The details of this I wasn't really too concerned about, but there are three major points I just wanted to hit. First is, and I apologize, you can't see the scales on these. This is an annual pattern from January through December in each case along the horizontal axis. And the vertical axis is temperature, in this case in Fahrenheit, because they prefer to deal in Fahrenheit. And you see, one, there's a large annual cycle. And basically it's going from somewhere around 35 up to 50 or 52. So you're getting a 15-degree annual cycle in temperature. It's a fairly large range. And, in fact, the Georges Bank, Gulf of Maine, and Mid-Atlantic region have what is a very large annual cycle in its temperature if you can compare it to other coastal regions. So that's number one. We have a large annual cycle. Number two, just to point out the types of interannual variability, and the bottom curves here down here are from 2004. These curves up here are from 2006. So that's just showing that the range, and this is 3 to 4 degree range interannually that occurred just recently in these areas. One of the interesting aspects of that, though, is that's the difference in the wintertime, and we don't know yet what it will be. We don't have the data back from the summer. As you look during the springtime, during the warming period, it actually, because they rise so rapidly, it's actually a fairly large difference. You should look at a particular day. It could be even larger. But what it really comes out to be in some respects is you can think of it, well, it's not so much as much warmer or colder as it is it's shifted in time. It comes earlier or later with that as well. So both of those issues may have importance. It may not just be that it's warmer or colder, but the warming is coming earlier and the seasonal pattern is coming earlier. So those are the three things I'd wish to make out of these. The main data set we have in looking at this is from the NIMS surveys, because we cover the whole Gulf of Maine, and we cover it about six times a year overall. And when we portray this, we deal it in terms of what we call anomalies. And basically, when we want to compare one year to another or one cruise to another, we don't want to have to deal with that large annual cycle that was just seen in the previous one. So we have a characteristic annual cycle that we subtract out so that we can just look at the differences that are occurring between years separate from that large annual cycle. And that's what we call an anomaly. So in this case, we're looking at the surface temperature on the left and salinity on the right from the NIMS surveys in the eastern Gulf of Maine, western Gulf of Maine, and Georges Bank. Each one of the little bars represents a different survey. And if you look at temperature, let's see if we can look at temperature, you can see this is from about 1978 up through coming into 2006. And certainly, if you look at temperature during the 80s, in particularly the Gulf of Maine area, yeah, it goes up and down a little bit. But these are pretty, plus or minus 1 degree, maybe something like that. When we get into the 90s, you can see, gee, the amplitudes go up and down a little more. It's been more variable. And it's had warming and cooling somewhat. You get onto Georges Bank, though, and really from the early to mid-90s, there's really been a more persistent set of warming. There's certainly variability in that from year to year. But overall, you're talking on the order of one, probably closer to 2 degrees, if you average it out over that period, warming that's occurred on Georges Bank. Again, you have a little bit, it has dipped down again and comes up again. But certainly during the late mid-90s to the early 2000s, we had, about a 2-degree warmer condition compared to the earlier time period. If you look in salinity, again, it goes saltier and fresher. But during the 90s here, we had very persistent low salinities throughout the Gulf of Maine, Georges Bank region. And this will become an important issue in terms of the oceanography. Those were the surface conditions. If we look at the bottom conditions, and in this case only dealing with the eastern and western Gulf of Maine, because Georges being shallow, it's not that much different along the bottom in these anomalies. The real big point here comes out if the... Well, the real big point that comes out in this is if you look at the Western Gulf of Maine, you know, during the 80s, it goes up and down a bit. You get into the 90s, boy, it's very persistently warm. Now, the scales are changed, so that's about a 1 degree warming, but it's pretty persistent throughout that whole later 90s. The Western Gulf, deep water in the Western Gulf of Maine was warmer by in the order of a degree, quite persistent. You go over to the Eastern Gulf of Maine, again, as you go into the 90s, it may be a little noisier, that is, it goes up and down more, but there really isn't that sort of same trend. You don't get that same feature in the Eastern Gulf. So the Western Gulf became warmer, and the Eastern Gulf really didn't. The last data is coming from the two buoys, buoy 7 and 5, and these now are, each of those bars represents a quarter. We've averaged the data into quarters, winter, spring, summer, fall. But just to, the point of this pattern is to say, these two buoys aren't all that far apart. And if you look at those patterns, they don't look the same that much. You know, the inshore one, you actually had a cooling coming in there, slightly colder conditions, late 80s through the mid 90s, and then it warmed up a bit. And buoy 5 offshore, very different pattern. So there's a lot of regional or spatial difference in these patterns of temperature. So when you summarize this into, okay, what was the, if you want to characterize it in simplest form, what was the environmental variability that we've seen? Say, well, first, I'd come back to that salinity event during the 90s, that there was a persistent low salinity occurring throughout the surface waters of the Gulf of Maine during the 90s. Two would be that those bottom temperatures in Wilkinson Basin were definitely warmer during the 90s. And third, that the Georges Bank waters, and particularly shown here by the surface ones I showed, those did show during the 90s a warming as well, on the order of 1.5-2 degrees warming. Other than those three events, or those three features, basically what you saw were things went up and down and all that, but it was just a lot of interannual variability. It wasn't really big, persistent trends that you saw there. So the point then is, okay, where is this coming from, and then perhaps what are some of the implications? So this gets back to, you know, quote some of the basic oceanography. If this is known, it is, you know, I apologize if this gets to be too generic. But first thing, okay, where does the water in the Gulf of Maine come from? Well, basically all the water in the Gulf of Maine, and my pointer is all the water in the Gulf of Maine basically is coming from two sources. There's water that comes in from the Scotian Shelf, this blue arrow here, and that's up in the surface layers, upper 50, 75 meters or so. And that's cold, and it's low in salinity. You have another input here through Northeast Channel, and that's oceanic offshore water, what we oceanographically call slope water, and that's warm and salty. So you've got cold, fresh, and you've got warm salt. And those two sources basically flow in, those waters come in, and in general do, you know, a counterclockwise circulation around the Gulf of Maine. They mix together, and they form the waters that then come up on Georges Bank, come around, and go off into the Mid-Atlantic Bight. So, but overwhelmingly, the water that's in the Gulf of Maine has come through one of these two sources and is a mixing product, basically, of those two waters coming in. That low period, that low salinity that we saw in the 1990s, we have observation to show us that low salinity was because this blue arrow, that water coming in from the Canadian shelf, was much higher transport. There's a lot more of that water coming in, basically about twice as much of it coming in during the 90s than there was during the 80s. That water is fresher, so that's what caused the low salinities. We have, during a program that we were involved with NSF, called Globec, there was another investigator doing it, had current meters here measuring that. So we have good observational evidence of this increased flow of the water from the Scotian Shelf. The cause of this change, we don't really know explicitly, but we do know in comparing it to other observations around that it's part of a large-scale change in the North Atlantic. This is not just a local phenomena. This, you might, you know, this is part of climate variability or climate change, whichever term one prefers, but it's not local. It is related to events that were happening probably from Labrador all the way down to our region. Now, we believe that there has been a general warming in the Northeast, and we see it pretty strongly in the Mid-Atlantic. We see it more strongly in the Mid-Atlantic. And that's an atmospheric warming that's been happening from the, you know, from the 80s through the 90s. When we get up to the Gulf of Maine, though, we got this increase of water from the Scotian Shelf coming in that's cold. So we really have two things, you know, battling against each other. We got a season, we have an overall atmospheric warming that's going on, and at the same time, we have this advective or transported cold that's coming in. In the Gulf of Maine region, that cold is enough to overshadow or at least counteract the warming. Varies a little bit seasonally. You get down to the Mid-Atlantic, it's much more evident, particularly in the southern Mid-Atlantic, that you had a warming, particularly in winter. You can see that. That coldness from the Scotian Shelf water has lost its kick by the time it gets down into the Mid-Atlantic. So we have both a warming and a cooling that has been going on. And that the other point in this is that when we look at changes in the Gulf of Maine and up under Georges, and these do carry on into the Mid-Atlantic, those changes in the water properties, those changes in the environment that the fish feel, is largely coming through those boundary fluxes. You know, what's coming in is determining an awful lot of the changes you see inside the Gulf. So they are carried in, those changes are carried into the Gulf by these inflows more than things happening directly inside the Gulf of Maine itself. And that ties the Gulf of Maine to those larger regional climatic basin scale type of changes. Another thing about the salinity is that, like temperature, salinity has an annual cycle. And if we go over to around Cape Sable, where that Scotian Shelf water is coming in, it has an annual cycle that looks something like this. The point being, it has its minimum here in the wintertime. Now, usually in coastal regions, your salinity decreases from the coastal runoff, from the rivers flowing in, and those are generally largest in springtime, and so your salinities commonly will be low when you get into the summer because it's accumulated all the seasonal runoff. Well, this minimum that we get off of Cape Sable as it comes into the Gulf actually represents the inflow from the previous spring up in the St. Lawrence, the Gulf of St. Lawrence, that's now traveled all the way down along Nova Scotia and finally arrives here, you know, 10 months later or so. But it's a very persistent, dominant feature of the oceanography here. So that low salinity enters in here. And basically, it gets carried around the Gulf of Maine with that circulation around the Gulf. And apologies again, these numbers are probably too small to see. This is the calendar day, the day of the year, 1 through 365, that any place has its minimum in the salinity. And over here, we're, you know, day 50, 70, 80 or something. But those waters come in and they flow around. And here we're at 160. So we're getting into May, 180. We're through June, 200. We're down in, you know, July and August. That signal that comes in from the Scotian Shelf that's really coming out of the Gulf of St. Lawrence from the previous year is traveling right around the Gulf of Maine and as far as the Western Gulf, ends up over here in the following summer. So if you look at the annual cycles, this was around Cape Sable. We look in Wilkinson Basin, we get this one. I mean, they're almost 180 degrees out of phase because that's the transport of water around the Gulf. So while Cape Sable is having its minimum in winter, Wilkinson Basin is having its maximum. What happens in winter? Well, things get cold. What happens to water when it gets cold? It gets dense. And if it's salty like this and dense, it gets real heavy and it convects. And you get good winter convection, overturning in the Gulf of Maine, in the Western Gulf of Maine with this. You get over to the Eastern Gulf of Maine, the surface salinities are low, you can almost freeze that solid, and it's not going to convect. It doesn't get dense enough. So in the western Gulf of Maine, you characteristically get good vertical convection. That mixes the water up, and it... I'm glad he's enjoying it. So you get good vertical convection in the western Gulf of Maine. What that convection does is that brings that cold from the surface down to the bottom. That's what cools the deep western Gulf of Maine. And if you look at the characteristic temperature at depth, this is 150 to 200 meters depth. If you go to Georges Basin and Jordan Basin, yeah, they cool down a little bit coming into the, you know, out of the winter. But if you go over to Wilkinson Basin, you see it really drops down. And that's the convection that characteristically takes place in winter. And then it slowly creeps up, but though it gets a real hit from that vertical convection. Okay, now we come back to 80s versus 90s that we were talking about. The blue dots here are from the 80s, or our, what was our Marmot program, 78 to 87. And you can see those are the ones that, you know, form that line that comes down and then slowly comes back up. These open circles are the ones from the 90s, all of our cruises from the 90s. And you can see almost every one of them basically is above, all these open circles are above the blue dots. This is that warming in the deep Wilkinson Basin that we showed earlier, that the bottom temperatures there were warmer. And the reason they're warmer was that low salinity that came in at the surface inhibited that winter vertical convection. We didn't get that overturning in the 90s. We didn't get that cooling coming down. So the western Gulf of Maine at depth stayed warmer in the 90s because of what was happening at the surface with salinity and not getting vertical convection. So those are the changes, those are the major changes we see in the environment. And a question would then be, what are the implications for the fish? When we think of environmental influence on fish, you can think of it in at least two different ways. One is you can have a real direct effect, you know, directly affecting that fish's behavior, its physiology, and generally think of that in terms of temperature, where they have a preferred temperature range. It gets out of that, they're going to move, or they may suffer because of that. Direct effects on the fish itself. Environmental changes can also have more indirect effects where it's affecting the plankton, it affects the food that the larval fish have, and on up, and affects the recruitment of the stock. Those are in bottom-up or more indirect ones. First ones are easier to document. The second ones are a lot harder. In terms of direct effects, so in truth, we don't see any really persistent major changes in temperature. Other than that western Wilkinson Basin at depth, and other than those, the warming on George's Bank, we're looking at plus or minus 1 degree sort of things, largely. And that's where and when the temperature is normally changing 10 or more degrees in its annual cycle, 1 or 2 degrees is not probably taking them really outside their envelope that much. It's not inconsequential, but it's not this big hit that's there. That warmer period in the 90s on Georges and then in deep part of Wilkinson, that's probably, you're up to 2 degrees or more, and that's something that might indeed be affecting distributional. There may be shifts in the populations, probably pretty subtle in all honesty. In what we've looked at, I haven't really seen, you know, an indication of that. But it's possible that those temperature changes would be enough to have some effect directly on the behavior of the organisms. Just as a passing point, that EMOLT data showed that the winter of 06 was pretty mild compared to some of the earlier years, particularly in the coastal areas. We think ultimately some of the more important things may be the indirect effects that come. And we know from some of the observations we've made in the Globec program and in other sampling that we've done that low salinity event that came from those changes of inflows of water from the Scotian shelf, associated with that, or at least the curves go up and down together. There's no direct no direct relationship except that the curves are going up and down together. It affected the phytoplankton, There were some changes in the zooplankton. There were some changes in the larval fish condition that we saw in Georges Bank in the GLOBEC program. So there were some ecosystem effects that were associated with that low salinity. Perhaps pretty subtle. It's an area right now of very active research within that program, the GLOBEC program, trying to synthesize that information and to be able to determine what those connections might be between those curves that are going up and down together. And was there truly an ecosystem level effect of that change in waters from the coming in from the Scotian Shelf? We don't have an answer to that now. We are, as I said, it's an active area of study, and we would expect within 1 or 2 years that there would be a final report that would be coming out of that program. And with that, I'd say thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you.
Any questions or comments? David?
I had a couple. It's very interesting stuff, and I think it's ultimately what we are going to need to understand in order to understand how fish populations fluctuate. And based on your beginning statements, when you said ask you some questions, one of the big questions the council always has is the issue of carrying capacity. How much stuff can the Gulf of Maine or Georges Bank hold? And from what I understand, sunlight ultimately determines how much stuff you can have. It's not nutrients. We have more nutrients than we have sunlight. But when we get these extremely large year classes and they're competing for food, are we starting to have carrying capacity issues? That's my first question.
I agree with you. It's a very important question. I don't feel I'm in a position to give any more definite answer than to say we agree with you. It's a very important question, and it's one that there are a number of studies underway trying to determine whether there is, whether that type of limitation or influence can be seen. One of the reports that is in press now from one of the GLOBEC studies, was looking at that in a decadal sense, the 60s versus the 80s versus the 90s. And I believe that did suggest that there was, in the data they were looking at, a suggestion that there was more production that was available in the 90s and the 80s than there had been in the 60s. Which might be reverse of what the standing stocks were at the time. But other than to say, I think it's an active area of study. I really couldn't give anything this definite.
Okay. My second question was one of the temperature graphs, to me, are very interesting. And the statement you made that is also interesting that I never really thought of is that any given area will move through a certain temperature at some time. It's just a question of whether it's in May or in July.
Right.
And that being said, and because I can't really do multivariate stuff in my head, I got to stick to one thing. So I'm just going to stick to temperature. And if you have something like cod, and they seem to spawn on a calendar basis more than a temperature basis, at least in Ipswich Bay, they come in and they spawn from mid-May to mid-June, say. But the water temperature can be extremely variable. But down the road, when those eggs hatch and they become larvae, they need something to eat. So something else has to hatch at about the same time in order for them to survive. And that stuff usually is some kind of, let's just say, plankton. We don't have to get into specific species. But if that doesn't happen because the temperature is too warm or too cold, and basically we have a whole bunch of larvae with nothing to eat and therefore recruitment failure. Well, so how are we even close yet to being at a point where we can look at these variables, temperature, salinity, some other ones, and predict any kind of spawning success when we understand the relationship between the spawn of the fish, the egg incubation period, and the larval phase, or at least get them to the point where they can settle on the bottom?
I think we're at the stage with programs like GLOBEC that I mentioned where this was brute force science in the sense we went out and measured as much as we could basically for a number of years. The first step we have to get to, and I think that that the synthesis that's taking place has good potential to get there. First, we have to be able to show that we can explain what did happen. And if we get comfortable that we have an understanding of what those relationships were that did happen when we have a lot of data, then we can start to feel that we may have some, we can pick out the most dominant factors and be able to say, okay, what will happen? I wouldn't say we're there at all yet in that. We do know, and we do see, like you're talking about the plankton, the plankton changes, the food changes. Yes, nature was kind to us in that program, and that it gave us quite a bit of variability to be able to see what are the implications of when things do vary. We have to be able to explain what did happen before we'll be able to do a prediction.
Fair enough. I got a lot of questions for you. I'm not going to tie up the council all day asking you, but I would like to talk to you some more because this is a subject that interests me personally.
Great.
Thanks, Dave. We have 15 minutes left, so if you have several questions, pick the one that you think is most important for the group and then try to catch up with them offline. Phil?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a nice presentation, Dave. I guess I got two, and I'm trying to figure out which one is quicker. It's bound by, what I've seen is all the temperature stuff, and that makes me wonder what you measured. I mean, by measuring temperature, have you calculated into that tidal conditions with it? I mean, the current that's moving that temperature around changes as the temperature changes. And I'm wondering how much of that is implicated in that.
Understand. Most of the data that we're dealing with from our surveys is really relatively offshore. And we're averaging over a wide area, a much wider area than what the tidal cycle would be and the displacements would be. And that's why we average these together to be able to give an answer that will be hopefully independent of those effects. If you get into the near coastal areas, and particularly into the estuaries or near the coast, it would depend upon what phase of the tide you're talking about. Even on George's Bank, we know from some of the measurements, you can see if you look at it on an hourly basis or as the front on the northern flank gets carried by you by the tide, your temperature can change, 5-7 degrees. You have that problem. Now, we think we do a broad enough coverage, integrating it enough that we have averaged that into our answer and to give a more characteristic answer than a specific moment in time.
I have a little problem with averaging, but we'll get to that
After
a while. So I want to point. The other question I have would be, with the increase in knowledge that you're getting here in the oceanographic part of this, how close does that come into the POPDI group or the stock assessment people in working this together as we're going forward and looking at cohesively at a whole picture? How close are you guys working now?
Those of us who are like me working in this part, particularly working in NIMS, the one thing we want to be is relevant. And if we're not relevant, as I tell the group, when we don't get funding and things as we want, I say the agency's critical mission deals with stock assessment and what happens with management and like that. And if we're not doing stuff that's inside that circle, it's sort of the crosshairs of a gun, I realize. If we're not inside that circle, we're second tier. There's not enough money for first tier. We have to get our foot inside that circle. We want to be there. It's not easy to get into that. We talk a lot with the POPDI group. They are very interested in what we do. We are exceedingly interested in what they do. And if we are continually seeking to find what we hope would be the first Nobel Prize in oceanography. because these are important questions, it's obvious. And they're very hard. If they were easy, people, they're a lot smarter than we would have solved them a long time ago. So we are certainly trying to get in that direction. I think what we will be able to do is, and I would hope within a couple of years, maybe sooner, who knows, at least be able to find one or two smoking guns that we can say, we don't have the whole answer, but this helps in one particular area versus another area, instead of trying to solve the big picture.
Paul?
Along the same lines as David Gaethel, persistent trends. So we've got like 25-plus years of data, recruitment data, salinity data, temperature data, 25-plus years. So when you say there's no persistent trends, that means there's no direct relationship that you've seen after 25, 30 years with recruitment and temperature, with recruitment and salinity. That's the way I read it.
Oh, I didn't mean to I don't think I meant to use the words that way. What I was thinking was, particularly in terms of temperature, which we get asked about a lot, because it's obviously a major driver for things. In talking to people, a lot of people come, when they ask that question, they have an expectation the answer is going to be this upward going graph that says it's getting warmer, it's getting warmer, it's getting warmer. And the issue that I was making when I said that was just that when you look at those things, yeah, they go up and down. But and even in the cases where they've gone up, say in Georgia, is there any deep Wilkinson, you can also say, hey, oh, well, there was another period that came down a little bit. So that's what I was saying, persistent trends.
But let me try to be consistent. We've always heard that there's a relationship between temperature, or there may be a relationship between temperature and recruitment. We have 30 years worth of temperature data and salinity data. We also have many more years of recruitment data. Is anyone at the Science Center overlaying this data?
Oh yes.
Okay. So that's good. That's good.
If we can get the Nobel Prize,
good.
We'll go for
good.
It.
Okay.
We want it.
But right now, after 30 years, we cannot see a persistent trend with any of that.
Right. And I would say that the suggest a change in the way you express it to say, I wouldn't really expect a relationship between temperature and recruitment, per se, unless you're outside of those bounds where you're influencing the real physiological aspects of the organism. Temperature and salinity in these cases particularly, which is why we think that salinity signal is interesting, it's a proxy for other things that are happening. Again, it's whether you're talking about that direct effect on the organism, which adults, they can move, or you're talking about those bottom-up. In the year-to-year interpreting catch information and things like that, that direct effect may be the most important one because they moved or something. When you're talking about productivity overall, productivity, as David was suggesting, well, at some level that's starting at the sun coming in, and that's going to come up through the system. And there are a number of different variables certainly in there. So it's not too surprising to us that in such a complicated system that we don't find nice, easy answers. But we think those parameters that we do measure, temperature, salinity, some other, chlorophyll, things like that, those are going to be proxies or indicators of the processes that are going on underneath. We are guilty, to some extent, to looking for the key under the lamppost. We can measure temperature. That's easy. We can measure salinity. It's hard to measure production. It's hard to measure some of the things. But we hope that these are indeed indicative of some of the processes happening. Hope does spring eternal, but the whole recruitment process there are so many different variables that can come in those straight relationships aren't going to be there.
Anyone else? Jim?
Thank you. I'd like to help Dave out a little bit because he's not a biologist, and I'm at the other side of that. And when we talk about recruitment, we're always talking about recruitment to the fishing gear or to our survey gear. But in fact, a lot of the measurements that Dave is making are relevant to the larvae which could be years away from a year or 2 years or 3 years away from recruiting. So it's not that surprising that it would be difficult to find a simple relationship between the recruitment and temperature. But the data that they're collecting is extremely useful for knowing about what might be happening to larval survival. For instance, on George's Bank, there's larvae pumped out all the time by ocean quahogs, but you have to have certain conditions where the physical conditions where the thermocline breaks up and the larvae can actually get into the photic zone to get their food. And so there may be larvae produced throughout the entire year, but only maybe during a month do those larvae actually, they're the ones that survive. So the physical measurements are very important that way for the larvae. Also, the data that they're collecting serves as a really great database for interpreting dramatic events that happen in the biology. Like I was in looking off Delmarva at clam populations, and there seemed to have been a big die-off of surf clams. We used the temperature database that was available to document that it was probably a die-off due to warming. So those are the kind of the ways that I've use the data as a biologist to interact with the physical oceanographers.
Okay, we probably have time for one more. Anyone else? Dave.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In line with that, I was wondering if you also tracked thermocline as well as the temperature during this time series.
Well, we do have measurements. Most of the measurements that we get are a vertical profile. So we do have information on the thermocline. And indeed, with thermocline coming, the stratification that exists within the water, and which can be a tremendously important parameter in terms of phytoplankton production with light and on. So we do track, we have the information on it, and we have tried different approaches to characterizing that in a way that we can create similar type of series to see that mixed layer depth or strength of the thermocline or depth of the thermocline. And it is, so yes. Now, have we found something that we have latched onto that we think is going to be in a single measure of that that's going to be useful in these type of longer term portrayals? And the answer to that is not really. We haven't. Because you could either do mixed layer depth, you could do strength of the thermocline. Well, is it over the upper 10 meters? Is it over 30 meters? It's a very variable type of parameter. So we do look at it. We know that it has importance. We haven't found a single index to use to match with these. When we look at more time-specific relationships, trying to find time-specific relationships with one set of observations to another, we indeed look at that.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we'll be hearing from you in a year or two. Maybe when that Globeck report comes out, you can come back and with another group of people and spend some more time breaking it down for us. Thank you. We'll take a lunch break. It's 12:30. We'll come back at 1:30.